Yle Podcast.
Paul Taylor, welcome to this little talk with me. I want to first introduce you to our Finnish audience. I mean, you carry a British nationality, but you have spent most of your life in Europe and somewhere in the Middle East.
Britain's in Europe too, by the way. It's just
on the continent.
Let's put it this way.
This is how fast we learn to not consider UK as part of Europe anymore. But truly and honestly, you've been working for Reuters for more than 4 decades. You've been based in Paris, in Brussels, in Bonn. You've covered, and Berlin, all kinds of EU issues. Now, if I tell you, if I say a word, Europe, what do you think?
Well,
what comes to your mind first?
Susanna, the first thing that comes to my mind is the flag with the 12 stars. Why 12 stars? There are more than 12 countries. Well, you know. And the next thing that comes to my mind, I think, is that it's my home. I feel myself a European. I did when I was growing up in Britain as well, which made me perhaps unusual. It's partly a generational thing. My mother used to tell her friends, "Paul works in Europe." You know.
Well, just what I did.
I said, you work in Europe. But when she talked about we're going to Europe, that meant going abroad. To me, Europe was something that I was part of. But to many people in Britain, and we saw that in last year's vote, Europe is somewhere that starts at Calais. And therefore, there's always been this kind of semi-detached feeling. It was Napoleon who allegedly said that a nation's policy was in its geography. And Britain, as there was a French geographer called André Siegfried who said that, never forget that Britain is an island entirely surrounded by water.
Now, if you go to Britain, do you feel abroad? Do you leave Europe and then you just go somewhere else abroad?
Well, it's funny going to Britain. I have a sister who lives in London. I visit her regularly. But first of all, there are all these problems about money. You know, you have to change currency. We on continental Europe have sort of forgotten about having to change currency just because you change country.
Yeah, it's a pain.
Maybe when you go from Finland to Sweden, you have to change currency, and that's
we use cards. Right. We use cards.
Well, the good news is that cards work in the UK as well. But there are strange things. Of course, they've always driven on the other side of the street of the road from most continental Europeans. There are many differences. But do I feel it's a foreign country? I feel rather strange because when you haven't lived in your own country for most of the last 4 decades, many, many things have changed. I don't know the TV celebrities. You know, when people talk about I'm sure it's the same in Finland. You know, you make references which are about celebrities that everybody knows. It's a common language because you all watch the same things, and then it's in your newspapers or magazines or on the internet. And I'm out of that conversation. So people look at me a bit like a relic from the last century.
But do you even know the French celebrities?
Well, I do. By dint of living here, I probably know the French celebrities better.
Right.
But they're the French celebrities of my generation, which is, you know, a student in the 70s, a young journalist in France in the 80s and in the 90s.
Let's go back. Well, let's go to France because I read a report that you recently wrote about France's role in European security and defense. Security was a big issue before the presidential elections first round. Defense, maybe not that much. What is the France's role? What was your finding, if you look at from a European perspective?
Well, France is kind of going to be the last little superpower left in Europe when Britain walks out that door. It has a permanent United Nations Security Council seat. It has a nuclear deterrent. It has a full-spectrum defense industry. It can make all its own major weapon systems. It has armed forces that are configured for and are used to intervening a long way from home, abroad, on different continents. And because of its colonial past and its residual overseas territories and departments, it actually has bases all over the world. So it's in the Pacific with Tahiti and with New Caledonia. It's in Latin America with French Guiana and with the French Antilles. So they have a very global view of security. Plus, they have bases in several of their former African colonies with which they have defense agreements. They are deployed all over the Sahel, the sub-Saharan Africa, which is so unstable at the moment and where there's a big threat from Islamist groups. They are in Djibouti, so on the straits that command the approaches to the Red Sea and to the Suez Canal. They now have a military base in the United Arab Emirates. This gives them both a security role in the Persian Gulf and also a sort of display window for their military goods, which they can sell to the Sunni Arab monarchies with which they are allied. So they have a full spectrum sort of defense thing, but they're really up against the limits of what they can achieve. They've done 6 new missions in the last 3 years. They are deployed far and wide. Of France's 77,000 soldiers, 30,000 are on active operational duty at the moment. 10,000 of those are in the streets of France, guarding buildings and helping to reassure the population because of a wave of terrorist attacks inside France by Islamists. Those Islamists are connected to Islamic State, so-called Islamic State militants who have territory in Syria and Iraq and in central Libya and in the Sahel. And they are all together sort of working to try and start a civil war, as it were, in Europe between Muslims and non-Muslims. And so France has a very vulnerable immigrant population, which suffers from disproportionately from unemployment, from economic deprivation, feels also culturally excluded to an extent. And that is a seed ground from which these Islamist jihadist groups can recruit.
So if I may interrupt, yeah. Just like all those, that colonial world, from Finland's perspective, yeah. It's just so far away and we don't have that background. We kind of look at France as the second biggest economy soon to be in Europe, with a massive military power compared with lots of smaller countries. England is, UK is pulling out. Trump says he doesn't really give a damn about Europe. Mm. Germany is sort of like, yes, but no, we can help Europe. So as a Finn, when I look at France, do we have any use for them?
Well, I think
in defense or security,
France plays a role in Finland's security. For example, by taking part in the NATO air policing mission over the Baltic states. Also, they're going to be sending French troops as part of the NATO forward presence in Estonia. They won't be in command, but it's important that there will be 300 to 400 French troops there because. You know, if you sit in France, Russia does not look like an immediate threat to your security, except, of course, for their questionable cyber activities, which maybe there is a lot of suspicion that Russia has been trying to sabotage the French election or influence the French election, as it's accused of having done in the United States and in other countries. So, but France sees that protecting Europe against Russia is part of its mission. It's not the number one priority in France at the moment. It's not the most immediate one. Also, holding the European Union together, making it successful economically, making the Eurozone successful, is hugely important to France's own security. I mean, if you look at what's the most dangerous thing that could happen to France, probably a collapse of the Eurozone would be number one. It's more important than a couple of bombs going off on the Champs-Élysées, even though that might get more headlines immediately. So France has a strong interest in Europe. And you can also see when the attacks happened in France in 2015, the French were committed in Mali, in the Central African Republic, and so on. They didn't use NATO's Article 5, collective defense article. What they did was to trigger the European Union's common defense article for the first time, Article 42.7. And the European Union met, and European partners came forward and said, all right, France, we'll help you. We'll try and help you by taking up some of your military responsibility for keeping the peace in the Central African Republic, in Mali. Are those strong Finnish national interests? Well, you could question that. But it's a give and take, and we're all in this together. And that's the message which France, I think, needs to convey, because it is, if there is going to be a more European defense initiative, it will have to be led by France, as you say, as the major military power. Germany will play a role, but it will take a long time to change Germany's strategic culture. You know, Germany has a generation or two generations of pacifists since World War II, for whom the armed forces are there to defend national territory, not to go fighting wars abroad.
Right, exactly. They just do peacekeeping jobs.
Exactly. So, you know, the French and the British have the same approach, which is from time to time you have to go to nasty places, kick down doors, and start shooting at people. Bad guys, as they are seen in France or Britain. The Germans have had that, perhaps fortunately, expunged from their culture. And so it will take a long time to build a European defense union or a Europe of defense. It has to be done because no one country, including France, can afford financially to do it all anymore. You know, France has a big armed forces with an economy that is stagnant. It's spending just under 1.8% of GDP on defense. That's less than the NATO goal of 2%. It's promised to get up to the NATO goal of 2%.
Very few.
By 2025, very few countries are doing it. Germany's spending at barely half of the NATO target. Now, of course, if Germany were to spend 2%, that would mean Germany spending 70 or 80 billion euros on defense a year. Not all of Germany's neighbors would be terribly happy to have such a big German military. But if more of that is pooled, if European countries, under French leadership at least partly, can produce their economic their military goods more effectively, share and pool some of their resources, such as air transport, where they already have that. I mean, at the moment, even France, when France was intervening in Mali, it was just as Russia was intervening in Crimea.
Now, consequently,
let me just finish my thought. The French didn't have the transport planes to take their troops to Mali. They had to hire them. Who did they hire them for? Russian and Ukrainian companies. Russian Antonov planes flew French troops to Mali at the same time as France was imposing sanctions on Russia over its annexation of Crimea. So, yes, France aims for strategic autonomy, but does it have it? Not completely.
The European Defence Agency has been there for a long time,
yeah.
But the problem is that the big countries don't want to share their purchases in military machinery.
Well, I think that that's been one of the big problems is the big countries each wanted to preserve their own technology, their own companies, their own share of work. You know, arms factories in my constituency is always a big thing for politicians, not just in Europe, but also in America. But the fact is that the threat has changed, that our defense budgets have gone down so far since the end of the Cold War. We're all spending so much less of a proportion of our GDP, we can't afford to do it anymore. And there's a study, a very good study by McKinsey that was done for this year's Munich Security Conference that shows that we could save tens of billions of euros a year if we were to procure more efficiently our main weapon systems together. So at the moment there are six different fighter planes major fighter planes in Europe. Three of those are produced by European countries. Could we agree that in the next generation fighter there will only be one European fighter aircraft that will be jointly produced? I'm not sure the Swedes...
Yeah, good luck.
I'm not sure the Swedes who have Gripen would necessarily agree to that. The French and the Germans probably can, and the French and the Germans and the British possibly could. But of course, with the British leaving the European Union, their interest in armaments cooperation will also be balanced by the sort of, shouldn't we be looking more of getting into more of the American defense market? And wouldn't we do better, therefore, to buy American planes? Because that gets us more of a trade-off with America, and we can then sell them our system. So there's a real risk that Europe fails to do this, but if it does fail to do it, it will have less bang for its euro.
Well, it's interesting because consequently, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was France who stopped the EU starting as a security and defense union.
In 1954.
Right.
The first attempt.
So what has changed the French mind?
Well, you know, so many things have changed since 1954. I mean, one of the big things that has changed in 1956, when the French and the British together intervened in Suez. They intervened to stop Egypt from nationalizing, taking over the Suez Canal, because they wanted to preserve freedom of navigation, which they regarded as threatened, and preserve the private companies that owned it, right? The Americans forced them to back off. The Americans basically said, we will call in all the money you owe us unless you pull out. And so this humiliation led Britain and France in opposite directions. France said, never again trust the Americans. We Europeans have to be able to do things on our own and with the Germans. Britain said, always hug America tight. Never get on the wrong side of America. And that has been the pattern ever since. So that's a big change. The second thing that's changed is that we no longer have the Cold War. In 1954, the reason that the French Parliament vetoed the European Defence Community was that they were worried about the rearmament of Germany. It was only 9 years after the end of World War II. And they were uncomfortable about Germany being militarized again. Now, nobody worries about that anymore. I mean, the worries are different. The strategic environment has changed so much. I mean, you listed the problems. You know, an American president who's not sure whether he really wants to come to Europe's rescue in security or not. A Russia that no longer is sure whether it wants to live within its own borders or not, and which is creating mischief in a number of former Soviet republics. A Turkey that is in a period of instability and authoritarianism and is at the same time the gatekeeper to Europe as far as migration is concerned. Daesh, these Islamic State militants.
ISIS.
All of this threat environment has changed. And these are threats to Germany as well as to Finland and to France. Of course, the degree Finland doesn't feel very threatened by Islamic State.
Not in the same extent.
Not to the same degree, right? But Germany now has bombs going off in Berlin, or people driving trucks into Christmas markets, and so Germany's threat environment is also evolving.
But you haven't started writing your report on Germany's role in European security and defense. Yeah. But Germany pops up all the time in this discussion.
Yes.
So, how do you think Germany and France could put their forces together so that both of them can stay happy? You know, not that the German military gets too strong, not that the Germans pay too much because the strong military exists already in France,
yeah.
And not to forget that there are 25 other member states in
of
this
course.
Union that should stay happy.
Right. So, first of all, the French have to agree that some of what is done in European defense has to be done under the European Union hat, so that all of the smaller countries feel that they are involved in it in some way. There's a good suggestion from a former French ambassador to NATO. There's a very good suggestion from a former French Europe minister, Elisabeth Guigou, that the European Union should hold a summit once a year, specially on security and defense, what she calls a European Security Council.
Not a bad
idea. Because European leaders need to take at the head of government, head of state level, ownership of security, not just leave it to their defense ministers and so on. And they need to sit around the table, discuss what are the threats to us, what are our resources, how are we doing, adopt a program with a timetable and review it once a year. How much progress are we making? And how can we leaders give the instructions to cut through the knots, the bottlenecks lower down in the system? So that, I think, is an important part of it. But, of course, Europe's never going to go to war by majority vote, not even qualified majority vote. So, in reality, the fighting will be done by nations, nation states, by coalitions of the willing. And often, France will be the country that does what's called first entry. They'll be the people going in and kicking down the door, possibly with the British, if the British are still involved, but the British are in a phase of intervention fatigue now, regardless of Brexit.
And they don't even know how to run their own country yet.
Right. And we don't expect that the Finns will come into Mali and start kicking down doors.
Probably not.
But what we would expect is that the Europeans get involved in what I perhaps derisively call the after-sales service. That's to say, once the French have gone in and done the hard security job, there is lots of work to be done in peacekeeping, in training the security forces of often weak states or failed states, in stabilization, in development aid, in institution building. All of these things are things that the European Union does well, and where we would expect that countries like Finland contribute proportionate to their ability. And in return, obviously, when Finland feels threatened, the rest of Europe has to be responsive to that. Now, I know that although Finland is not a member of NATO, it tends to look to NATO and to the United States more than to the European Union for its own security.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. I had a discussion, this same issue, with our president, Sauli Niinistö, and he was astonished, telling me that, you know, as he has taken up this conversation issue with other leaders in Europe, that they're sort of like, oh, well, it's security, it's not our job, it's NATO. Well, since we don't have NATO, and he is convinced that, like you mentioned earlier, this defense article, which exists in EU treaty,
yep.
He trusts in that, and so should Finland, because we don't have NATO. If we continue,
but you have a very close cooperative relationship with NATO.
Yes,
you do training and exercising interoperability, as it's
exactly.
called, right? And that's really, I think very important for Finland. It would be great if the European Union were doing more, but if you ask people in France, and I think in Germany and so on, would you ever want to get into a situation where we were in a confrontation with Russia without the United States being actively involved on our side? I think the answer would be no.
Of course it would.
Right. So while we expect the Europeans to do more for ourselves in security, it's not going to be doing more for ourselves on our own vis-a-vis Russia.
But equally, it would be odd for a Finn to not to be able to trust, let's say if we felt threatened by the Russians,
yeah.
Not to be able to trust that our European allies would come for help.
Well, exactly. And so I think that you could imagine further down the road a situation where if Finland felt threatened, that the European Union countries might want to consider the sorts of things that they are now doing through NATO for the Baltic countries. That's to say, an enhanced forward presence, as it's called in the NATO jargon, which means rotating troops in Finland, if necessary, if Finland really felt threatened. But you'd have to, you know, the Finns themselves would have to decide what the balance was between diplomacy with Russia and defense. I'm not sure whether at this stage Finns would welcome European Union country forces on their territory in the way that they are now being stationed, rotating in Poland or in Lithuania and Latvia and Estonia. But we should consider it. And also, and this is perhaps going to be even more controversial, it applies a little bit to the nuclear umbrella as well. During the Cold War, the United States provided a nuclear guarantee for NATO and for Western Europe. Since then, the American nuclear umbrella has been there. There are still American nuclear weapons in Europe, and there are European countries which are able to deliver nuclear weapons with their aircraft. But the question about America's willingness to die for Danzig or for Gdansk or for Helsinki or for Tallinn, it's a more open question, and especially with Donald Trump in the White House. So the question is, does Europe say, well, we don't need a nuclear deterrent, or we don't need a nuclear deterrent we can be sure of anymore? Or does Europe say, well, France has a nuclear deterrent, which covers its vital interests. Could we cooperate in some way that would lead the French to consider, as a matter of doctrine, that any attack on any of the European Union's territory would be an attack on its vital interests?
Is that a make it or break it for Europe's defense and security cooperation? What kind of leaders Germany and France have during this year, or who they choose?
Germany hates to be alone in leadership. The whole of its history is keine Singularität. You know, let's not allow ourselves to be singled out. So France and Germany are the backbone of the European Union. They are the central partnership. They like to say, particularly since the eastward enlargement and the northern enlargement of the EU, that their partnership is necessary but no longer sufficient. But essentially, they still represent the northern and southern dimensions of the European Union, perhaps not as well the eastern and western dimensions, but the northern and southern dimensions. So a compromise between France and Germany on the way forward for Europe is likely to represent Finnish interests and Portuguese interests, Greek interests and Irish interests. And that's why France and Germany are so important. So I would see, in the best of circumstances, a grand bargain being struck between the new French president, the pro-European Emmanuel Macron, and that he has a free hand in government, which is by no means certain because he has parliamentary elections
coming up in
June, in which he may not win a majority and where his hands may be, to a greater or lesser extent, tied. And in Germany, a pro-European government. But again, in Germany, it's true that both the major candidates are pro-European and that whatever coalition emerges from the next German election, and there are always coalitions, it will be a pro-European coalition. But there are nuances, because this grand bargain has to be not just on security and defense, which we've been talking about, and where the German Social Democrats are still very reluctant, still have very much a pacifist side, and are worried about doing hard security. But also, it has to be on the future of the Eurozone. And there, it's the conservatives, the Christian Democrats, perhaps the Free Democrats, the Bavarian Christian Social Union, who are very worried because they always think that Europe is trying to pick Germany's pocket. And they will continue, I think, to be very reluctant about more mutualization of European financial resources, whether it's a budget, specific budget for the Eurozone, or whether it's some kind of common issuance of debt, some kind of common borrowing. And one possible area for common borrowing, which again might make people less worried about a more powerful Germany, is if they could do joint borrowing to fund joint procurement of weapons systems. Would it not make sense to have some seed money in a fund? I mean, why is it that we can have the Juncker Fund, which helps us build roads and bridges and airports and things?
Yeah, infrastructure.
Infrastructure, but not military infrastructure. Not a hardened aircraft shelter.
Who's going to own them?
Well, these are all national projects. Ultimately, the owners will, in my view, remain national. There are examples where NATO, for example, owns some resources in common. The AWACS planes, you know, those airborne surveillance and warning control systems, which have the funny mushroom on top of the jumbo jet.
Yes.
Those planes are owned in common. There's a fleet of them, a dozen of them, in Geilenkirchen in Germany on a base. The problem is, when France and Britain led a NATO intervention in Libya in 2011, the Germans opposed the intervention. They abstained at the UN Security Council. And even though this intervention had the blessing of the United Nations, of the NATO Council, and of the European Union, when Britain and France came to Germany and said, can we have the NATO AWACS, please? The Germans said, well, you can have the planes, but you can't have the German crews. And the German crews made up 40% of all the crews. So it was incredibly inconvenient. And that's a real warning light, because if you can't be sure that you can actually use those military resources when you need them, you're not going to pool them and share them. And the same thing, if you produce armaments together with a country like Germany, but you can't be sure you'll be allowed to export them to your customers, and your whole business model of defense depends on being able to export a lot of arms so as to reduce the unit price for your own armed forces, then you're not going to produce weapons jointly with Germany. So those problems must be fixed.
Right. Well, something's going to happen with our joint defense and security policies, if not this year, but sooner rather than later, I'm sure of it. But so that this discussion is just not arms and crisis,
yeah.
Europe is so much more. It's about cultures, it's about languages, it's about arts and so forth. Of all your life in Europe, I want to ask you this. Is there somebody particularly who has influenced you? Somebody, I don't know, a writer, an artist, a singer, or a military leader?
Well, I've had journalistic mentors from many European countries. In fact, there was a wonderful Dutchman called Michael Steyn, who was a Jewish child who was rescued and looked after by Dutch Calvinist family during World War II, and then became the great Middle East correspondent of NRC Handelsblatt. And I met him in my first big journalistic job covering Ayatollah Khomeini in France in 1978-79. And I learned a lot from him. And one of the things I learned from him, which I think is very Jewish and very Central European in a way, but is very European, is he began every interview with the question, I don't understand. We're apprentices all our life. We're always trying to understand. And my final question as a journalist when I'm doing interviews is always, is there anything I forgot to ask you? For the same reason, because sometimes people have something deep in them and you didn't ask the question that brought it out. So that's an example of a European. But there are so many Europeans that have inspired me in terms of arts, in terms of culture. Ariane Mnouchkine and the Théâtre du Soleil here in France, the wonderful theater. Pina Bausch and dance from Germany. Jussi-Pekka Salonen and other musicians, composers, and conductors from Finland. I'm a great music lover. I'm a jazz lover. Jazz was an American music form, basically, but it was brought to and sustained by Europeans as well. So I love, when I hear Richard Galliano, a French accordion player, playing the music of Astor Piazzolla from Argentina. You know, that's Europe too. And we do, as you say, we share a lot of this. We have so much in common. Is this the year when the pro-European fight back begins? I think it is. You know, it doesn't mean that it will be easy. It certainly doesn't mean that we can afford to be complacent just because they didn't win the Austrian presidential election by a hair, just because they didn't win the Dutch parliamentary elections, the French presidency. There's still a big concern out there. And another country to watch is Italy, because if Italy were to go down, it's too big to save. And if Italy were to go down, it could take the Eurozone with it as well. But certainly, finally, there's a sense that pro-Europeans, very late in the game, are being shaken out of their complacency. You see small groups, not large crowds, but you see small groups going out in Paris and Frankfurt and bigger crowds actually in London to demonstrate in support of the European Union, not for any particular demand, but just to say, hey, you know, the European Union matters. It's important to us. We take it so much for granted. We take its achievements for granted. And I understand it. You know, I have children who are in their 20s and 40s. And when you say that, you know, the European Union has preserved peace and prosperity on the continent, they kind of give you a blank stare, you know, like, well, so what's new about that, Dad?
well,
and,
it's...
You know, the answer is, I go back to François Mitterrand's great farewell speech to the European Parliament, 1995. He's dying of prostate cancer. It's the end of 14 years in office. He's had light and shadow, but he's been one of the great leaders of the European left. And he comes to the European Parliament towards the end of the Balkan Wars. And he says, Mesdames et Messieurs, le nationalisme, c'est la guerre. Ladies and gentlemen, nationalism is war.
This is an excellent quote to finish this discussion. Thank you, Paul Taylor.
Thank you.